You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to the show. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, when you think of the word slavery, it might cast your mind back to the Civil War and to the antebellum South, but it turns out that slavery is alive and well, and the evidence of it is on our collective dinner plates. Benjamin Skinner is senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism. He's been investigating where our seafood comes from and has found evidence of modern slavery on a wide scale. His new piece on the topic is in the current edition of Bloomberg Newsweek. It hits the newsstands today, and he's in the studio with me now. Benjamin, welcome.
Thanks. Very good to be with you.
It was a compelling and fascinating and daunting read that you put together in Bloomberg Business Week. You focus on an Indonesian man named Yusril. Now, this is a pseudonym, not his real name, as I understand
Correct.
It. Who is he, and why is he in this story?
Sure. He was one of over two dozen survivors who spoke to me at great personal risk to tell their stories of being recruited by extraordinarily exploitative and thuggish recruiters in Indonesia, put to work on Korean flag ships fishing in New Zealand's exclusive economic zone. On those ships, they were brutalized. They were beaten up. They were verbally harassed. Their families back home were threatened if they complained. And there was endemic sexual abuse, including rape, which was something I did not expect to find.
Now, you describe that the article is about slavery. It's in the title, and you crack this article. And my first impression is, well, okay, the conditions are horrible. Mm-hmm. They don't have labor standards like we have. There are ships, you know, there's no responsibility because it's part Indonesia, mm-hmm. it's part Korea, it's part New Zealand. I get all that. But there is a salary here. This isn't slavery, is my first impression, until you drill down a little bit.
Until you drill down and understand the pay structure. Essentially, these individuals are working for free for the first 3 months. If they survive the first 3 months, they're making on average about a dollar a day. The main character, Yusril, was making about a dollar an hour for extraordinarily difficult and exploitive work. And the main character, Yusril, was making about 50 cents an hour. My definition of slavery, and I've been writing about this for 10 years in a book called A Crime So Monstrous, was the compilation of a lot of my work on this. Slaves are those forced to work, held through fraud, under threat of violence, for no pay beyond subsistence. These are people that cannot walk away without dire consequences to them or their families, and that was exactly the situation with these folks.
Now, there's the low pay that they get for the work, but then there's also threats and consequences should they get fed up with the situation, which a lot of the characters in your story did, and walk away. They have contractual penalties on themselves, on their families, not to mention other forms of penalties like intimidation.
Absolutely. You know, I'm used to dealing with Nigerian human traffickers who are offering to sell me a 12-year-old girl in inner city Bloemfontein in South Africa or underground brothels in Bucharest. I mean, those are the kind of people I'm used to going up against. They don't put things down in writing. They're at least a little bit smarter than the recruiters. The recruiters put together these contracts that look like something out of the 19th century, and I have these contracts. That's a smoking gun. It's undeniable evidence that these people are forced to work. If they walk away, their property is seized. In many cases, they've had to turn over titles to their land to these recruiters. And if they walk away, their families are ruined.
This title is collateral to keep them on the job.
Absolutely.
In some cases, those contracts they signed were not even in the language that they speak.
That's true. And the contracts that they signed in English were strictly for presentation to New Zealand authorities if they came and investigated the situation. They didn't know what was in those contracts until for those 24 that finally walked off in protest, believing they would be protected by the New Zealand government. That's when they first learned what was in those contracts. For the record, so far, the New Zealand government has not stepped up and protected them, and 22 of them were deported.
Now, New Zealand is an industrialized country, a modern country, for whatever that quite means in this situation. Mm-hmm. They have labor standards. You mentioned, I think, New Zealand labor law is graced by 1,000 pages of statute. Mm-hmm. What has it meant You said they haven't protected these 24 fishery workers who walked off the job. Yeah. But what about the companies? What are the heads of these companies that are buying the fish and running these vessels say to you when you approach them about this?
Well, in the story, I quote the head of one of those companies, one of those New Zealand companies, talking about those labor laws. And his exact quote was, you know, New Zealand labor laws are 1,000 pages of, you know, beautiful stuff, but they don't necessarily apply beyond the 12-mile territorial radius of our country. In other words, out there, while the Ministry of Fisheries is extraordinarily careful of their ecological, their what they call their biological resource, meaning the fish, they protect the fish from overfishing, but they don't protect human beings from slavery between 12 and 200 miles out.
Is this fundamentally an issue of ships sailing around in international waters where nobody's law applies? I mean, there is what I think is called a law of the sea, right? Does that not apply here? Does that not protect humans? How does it work?
It doesn't apply because when we're talking about 12 to 200 miles out of off of New Zealand, we're talking about what they claim is their exclusive economic zone. They patrol that through satellite imagery. They patrol that through onboard biological observers. What they don't do is adequately enforce human rights law out there.
One important part of the story is that the fish that are caught, either trawled or on long lines, under these horrific conditions, do find their way to American dinner plates in restaurants and in grocery stores, Costco, Sam Club, in a great big way. Mm. Do we have any real sense of how important this type of labor is to keeping our fish prices low, essentially? What does it mean to us when we're making our dinner choices?
Sure. And to be clear, this was an extraordinarily difficult part of the process to track. This was a shockingly opaque industry, and figuring out who buys what and how it gets on our plates was the most challenging part of this. From our best estimates, the most highly infected species coming out of New Zealand right now is squid. If you're eating
infected with slavery,
if you're eating New Zealand squid in the United States, by our estimate, there's a 40% chance that you're eating squid that's infected with slavery, that's caught on one of these vessels where at least one person has reported being a slave, and in many cases, many more.
Is it labeled caught in New Zealand? They call it country of origin labeling. Sorry to be wonky, but is it labeled so that you know?
It's labeled as a product of New Zealand. It is not labeled as caught with slave labor, surprisingly.
No, and it wouldn't be. squid and what else? And by the way, these labels are in your grocery store. They're not in your restaurant.
That's true. And although in many cases I find that if you go into a restaurant, ask the country of origin, they'll tell you. And I'll tell you what, I'm a pescatarian. I've been eating a lot of fish my entire life, and I will not order fish from a restaurant anymore without asking the country of origin.
Do our big retailers, not to single them out, but Costco, Sam's Club, you name it, are they aware of the origins of their fish? Are they aware in any way of the labor conditions that produce them? Is this something that even goes into their calculus?
As of last Friday, they are getting aware very quickly.
I would think so.
I doorstepped many of these companies, and to their credit, many of them responded very, very swiftly. Walmart and Safeway were within hours. They'd launched a full-scale investigation. The results of that investigation have not come out yet. I haven't heard much from Costco, but I understand through sources that they're working behind the scenes and cleaning up their supply chains. So, you know, change can happen, but it takes consumer response.
Before we let you go, Benjamin Skinner, where is Yusril now, right now? What's his situation?
He is still in Central Java. And this is the hardest part about doing journalism, because when individuals like this bear witness, he has no protection. He is in a situation where I got a text message from him at 3 in the morning saying, "Strangers in my house." This is after the piece was posted online. I'm running with my family. He's now in hiding. I've contacted the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, but I want to send a message that for those responsible for intimidating my sources, you can come after me because my reporting is bulletproof. You do not come after a 28-year-old source, his 22-year-old wife, and their 1-year-old son. That's despicable.
We wish him the best. We wish his colleagues the best, and all of those who've been exploited aboard these vessels. Benjamin Smith, I commend you for your reporting and for bringing light to the situation in waters and on our dinner plates. You're listening to Benjamin Skinner. senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism. Read his story in Bloomberg Businessweek.